Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries over the Internet worldwide. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the food crisis when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Well, Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it and I know it. And there isn't one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now you know it and I know it. Then what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of this Global 2000 program, the New World Order. They're the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. Let's wise up. Now, let's start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists and philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and to survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, call and order my 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Well, the looming food crisis has now taken front and center stage over the war in Iraq. In fact, in Americans' minds today, the war in Iraq only affects about 20% of your thinking, and about 60% of your thinking now is on inflation, or the economy. Food prices, which have gone up in this country by 69% in 1 year. And of course, in the Consumer Price Index, food and fuel are not counted. Those are two items that I think all of us use, or at least most of us, unless you're an Amish man. All of us use food, and most of us use gasoline. And those two items aren't in the CPI, Consumer Price Index, and they give us what they call hedonics. It's more scientific. What it is a damn lie, as Mark Twain used to call it. And they use this damn lie to keep you and I in the dark as to what's really going on in the world. Fortunately, there are reporters in the world, like John Swinton, who call a spade, and say, well, let me tell you what's going on, and here's where it's going on, and here's the source of information that I got it from. Most people don't get their news from the underground press. They get it from Katie Couric and Brian Williams and Charlie Gibson on ABC, CBS, and these are the places that are actually telling us about the food crisis. Actually, Moses told us about the food crisis in Deuteronomy chapter 28 about 3,100 years ago. And then the Apostle John told us a little bit more about the food crisis in Revelation chapter 6 about 2,000 years ago. And then a guy by the name of Malthus, back in the 1700s, he came up with a novel theory. He said that if the population grows exponentially, geometrically, it grows 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, it doubles every so many years is what he's pointing out. He said, but food production grows arithmetically, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the geometric model is going to overcome the arithmetic model at some point in the future. And people have been talking about Malthus and Doomsday and Chicken Little, you know, for the last 200 or 300 years. It's kind of like peak oil. You know, there is a time in life, there's a time in history when we are going to physically exhaust all of the oil reserves on planet Earth. That time, they tell us, is upon us at this moment in time. I showed you here in the last few weeks that that was a lie. It is coming. I don't deny that there is a thing out there called peak oil, but peak oil isn't physically upon us, it's politically upon us. And there's another story that has to do with food. Now, I don't know how many people can fit on planet Earth. I'm not that smart. The people who are in control of planet Earth believe that 6 billion is way too many, and that the Earth cannot support 6 billion people. I subscribe to the other side of the coin, that there's a God, there's a creator, there's a design, there's a plan, and that he probably knows better how many people the Earth can support than I do. I'm not here to tell you that I know the answer. I'm just here to report that there are people out there that believe there's too many people in the world, and they're busily trying to eradicate 90% of them. That's their plan. That's what they've published. That's what they said. And I believe them. I think they're serious people, and I think they're intelligent people, and they know where they're going, and they know about how they want to get there. And so my concern is that the 90% that they're going to eradicate might be me, that I might be in that 90%. Now, I'm not concerned about you getting eradicated, partner. I'm just concerned about me getting eradicated. They call them useless eaters, useless eaters. And there's a food crisis now upon the world, and the thing that's unique about this food crisis in the year 2008, 9, 10, 11, long, as we go into the future here, is that this one's worldwide, and in the past, historically, famines have always occurred regionally or locally. Up until 2008, all famines in the world over the last, you know, 4,000 years of recorded history have been local or regional. They've never been worldwide. And now we have a worldwide food crisis in which 40 countries in the world, 40 out of about 192, are chronically short of food and are in a crisis mode. Now, here in the United States, we don't have a crisis mode. We just have high prices. So what we're suffering from here is an inconvenience. But the other day, I was doing a little arithmetic here. The average person in the world, and I say average, 3.5 billion people in the world, that's a little over half, live on $2 a day. $2. For you Englishmen, that's about £1 per day. And here in the United States, that's 2 Federal Reserve Note dollars. Not 2 silver dollars. Not 2 real money dollars. Just 2 specious Federal Reserve Note dollars. That's what they live on every day. and they spend around 80% of that $2 a day on food. These are people that live in Bangladesh and India and Ceylon and Africa, you know, people in the poorest part of the world. There are people, and there's a bunch of them, that live on $1 a day. $1 a day. Here in America, I don't know of anybody that can't panhandle. I mean, hell, you could go out here and just stand on the street corner and hold your hand out and make more than $2 a day. Now, sometimes people say, well, yeah, but those people over there have a lower standard of living and prices are cheaper. Well, that probably is true. That's probably got a lot to do with it. For instance, looking at prices down in Venezuela, the price of gas last time I heard was 12 cents a gallon. Now, over in Nigeria, the price of gas is around $3 a gallon. And the people in Venezuela, I don't know what their standard of living is. I don't know what their average daily income is, whether it's $2 or $30. I don't know. I suspect that it's probably around $5, $6, $8 a day, maybe. In Mexico, if you're working, you're probably making $9 a day. That's the last number I saw in Mexico. So I'm assuming that down in Venezuela, they're making $9 a day. Probably not, but maybe. And gasoline is 12 cents a gallon. God, that's really good. You know, that's really good. Here in the United States, we make $17.58 an hour. That's the last number I got. Let's plug that one in. $17.58 times 8 hours a day. We're making $140 a day here. And it costs more to live here. But proportionately, when you take that fellow in Nigeria who's making $2 a day and the price of gasoline is $3, he has to work two-thirds of a day. I mean, you know, he's making $2. And then he works a whole day, rather, not two-thirds. He works a whole day, but he can only buy two-thirds of a gallon of gas. The guy in Venezuela, he's making, let's say he's making $9 a day. And I'll just plug in $9 here. And we divide that by 0.12. He can buy 75 gallons of gas with his day's work. And as we go around the world and we take a look at prices of other things, other than just food, but you know, other things. In England, the last number I saw here was $9.70 a gallon for unleaded gas and $10.40 a gallon for diesel. And we here in the United States, for all you Englishmen, price of diesel hit $4 a gallon here. We're just crying our eyeballs out. We make $140 a day. Price of gas, price of diesel is around $4 a gallon. It's actually under that price of gas here nationwide average. I think it's $3.50, right at that, as I speak. But it's going up pretty dramatically. It's going up. And it's going up every day. And the dollar is going down, down and down. And the prices of fuel are going up, up and up. But taking our $140 and just divide that by, let's take 4. We can buy 35 gallons of gas a day with it, with a day's labor. So I go out and I work a day, make $140 and pay $4 a gallon for gas, and I can get 35 gallons. The guy in Nigeria can get two-thirds of a gallon. The guy in England, I don't know what you people in England are making, but I would assume that you're making $100 a day or more, you know, if you're an average run-of-the-mill Joe six-pack in England. And you're paying $10 a gallon. Well, if you're making the same $140 that I'm making over here, and we divide that by $10, you know, round it off, you can get 14 gallons. And we Americans are just crying our eyeballs out. We're actually better off than anybody else. And we've been better off than everybody else in the world. And then we complain more when the prices go up. And I say that because, you know, the price of food has gone up by 69%. That's unheard of. We've never seen that happen in this country. And indeed, we haven't seen that happen in the world in history. This is monumental. This is something really new. I don't see this being reported on the news. It would seem like to me that a never-before event that affects everybody on planet Earth ought to at least come up with a two-minute story on the CBS Evening News. You know, We have little vignettes about cancer every night on the 6 o'clock news. There'll be a report on cancer and cancer research and so on. And I don't deny cancer is important, and I guess cancer is interesting. And then they have little stories, you know, about human interest. You know, there's a fellow by the name of Hartman comes on every Friday on CBS Evening News. I kind of like to watch his story. And he'll go out and pick on some individual and tell us a little story about that individual living here in America and what he's doing and what he did and these unusual human interest stories, they call those. And they put those on the CBS Evening News. I don't know that that's news. It would seem like it would probably fit in better with Oprah or something like that, but they call it news. They put it on the news. News, to me, from my perspective in life, is when you're learning something about the world that you didn't know before. That's history making. For instance, there that cyclone that just hit Burma, for instance. Now that's quite a little story, and that's being reported on the news every night. And to me that makes sense. That's a newsworthy event. 22,000 people dead, you know, as I speak, and 40,000 people missing, and whole villages wiped off the map and they just disappeared and so on. That sounds like news to me. And it also sounds like news to me when we find that 40 nations in the world, 40, and they're scattered all over. They range from Africa to Asia to Latin America. And these people are short of food. And you have riots going on in Haiti here in the Western Hemisphere and in Africa and in Asia, in Southeast Asia. Now, it doesn't affect you Japanese. You know, you've got plenty of food. That's because you got plenty of money. You know, you're not living on $2 a day in Japan. And you're not living on $2 a day in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, and Western Europe. But the prices are going up, and people are getting concerned about that. And here in America, when they're taking a poll, you know, who are you going to vote for? The number one issue now is the economy. That's the number one. It's pushed Iraq right off the map. Everybody's concerned now about the economy. And I think that we probably ought to be. Probably ought to be. It's why I said I think this food crisis over here is pretty important. And there's reasons now for the food crisis, and they're being advanced. And they're telling us, you know, well, the reason we have this food crisis is because of the declining dollar, drought in Australia, or because of the perfect storm, you know, global warming is coming into the play. And so we have all these excuses as to, well, why is this happening? Then why is it happening now? Well, there's 545 people in the world. And indeed, there's 545 people that all live here in the United States that are responsible for every political, social, and economic event going on planet Earth today. That's right. There's just this little group of people, very public people, right out in the open people. People that you know, people that you see reported on the news every day. 545 of these people that control things like, you know, the prices of food in Haiti and the ethanol program, the IRS, the war in Iraq, inflation, immigration policy, the Federal Reserve, tax policy, genetically modified organisms, global warming policy, and budget deficits, and so on. And these are the 545 people in our Congress, the White House, and the Supreme Court. And these 545 people govern it all. Listen, you know, politicians are the only people in the world who create problems and then campaign against those problems. They create them, number one, and then they run out in the streets and they say, oh my God, we got this problem, and you should elect me so that I can go solve it for you. Have you ever wondered why, if both Democrats and Republicans are against deficits, have you ever heard a politician get up and say, listen, what we need is more deficits? That our federal budget is running $300 billion in the red this year. Elect me, and we'll have a $600 billion federal deficit. I can double it. I've never heard any politician, Republican or Democrat or conservative or liberal or anybody, that's ever campaigned for deficits. And yet, between 1933 and as I speak today, we have had two balanced budgets in that 75 years. Two. Now, you can't count the Clinton years. Don't count any balanced budgets during the 8 years Bill Clinton was in office. That was a George Bush smoke and mirrors operation if I ever saw one. They just manipulated the numbers and told you that there was a budget surplus. That was hocus pocus BS. But hell, even if you counted eight budget surplus years, you've only had 10 out of 75. How would your family budget look if out of the past 75 years you had 10 surpluses and all the rest of them are deficits? That if you started out with $2 billion worth of debt and you pyramided it into $9 trillion worth of debt. You know, a trillion is 1,000 billion. So that's two against 9,000. I mean, you know, let's take 9,000 and divide that by two, and that'd be 4,500. 4,500 times more debt. Would you say that you were a success? Have you ever wondered why, if all the politicians are against inflation, that we have inflation? I've never heard any politician stand up and say, listen, vote for me and I'll give you more inflation. If you think 69% price increases are good, wait until you elect me. If a declining dollar and more inflation is good for us, wouldn't twice as much be even better? Both Republicans and Democrats tell you, I'm against inflation. Then we elect them to office, and then you get these Republicans and Democrats. They're all sitting in the Congress, they're all sitting in the White House. And I suppose, although we claim that our Supreme Court's non-political, I suppose those guys have some kind of political. I mean, they're all eligible to vote, I guess, the nine members of the Supreme Court. You know, they must go down and vote once in a while. And when they vote, who do they vote for, Republicans or Democrats? You ever wondered why we have high taxes? You know, the second plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for a heavy, progressive income tax. Here in America, well, for that matter, all you people in Western Europe and Australia, New Zealand and Canada and here in the United States. In fact, I'll just bet you that worldwide we have heavy, progressive income taxes everywhere in the world. It's the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. I've never heard of anybody that came up and said, hey, vote for me because I want more taxes. I think taxes are high and they need to go higher. Republican or Democrat, I don't care who he is. Have you ever heard somebody just stand up and say, we want higher and higher taxes? So why is it then, if everybody is opposed to, that Republicans and Democrats and plumbers and carpenters and electricians and ditch diggers and truck drivers, everybody is against budget deficits, higher taxes, and inflation. And yet we get higher taxes, more inflation, don't we? All right. Now, you and I do not propose the federal budget. It's the president that does that. It's the president of the United States. One guy. He stands up and says, here's the way I think we ought to spend this money. You and I do not have the constitutional authority to vote on appropriations. The House of Representatives does that, those 435 people in the House. You and I do not write the tax code. The Congress writes that. You and I do not set fiscal policy. Congress does that. You know, you and I do not control monetary policy. The Federal Reserve Bank does that. Now, there's 100 senators, 435 congressmen, one president, and nine Supreme Court justices. That's 545 human beings out of 300 million. And they are directly, legally, morally, and individually responsible for the domestic problems that plague our country today. Those 545 people did it. They either did it or they didn't do it. They either did something that they shouldn't have done, or they didn't do something that they should have done in order for us to have the high taxes, high inflation, 69% price increase in food, mean, I didn't do that. You didn't do that. But these 545 people did do that. Now, I excluded the members of the Federal Reserve Board because that problem was created by Congress. They did that back in 1913 when they created the Federal Reserve. In 1913, Congress delegated its constitutional duty to provide our monetary system, you know, to coin and mint money, to provide a sound currency. They gave that power away to a federally chartered private bank called the Central Bank. And I excluded all of the special interests, the lobbyists, and I did that for a sound reason. These lobbyists have no legal authority whatsoever. They don't have any ability to coerce any senator. They don't have any power over our congressman or the president to do one cotton-picking thing. Now, I don't care if they offer a politician $1 million in cash for a bribe. The politician has the power to accept or reject that bribe. And no matter what the lobbyist promises, it is, in the final analysis, the legislator's responsibility to determine how he votes on each and every one of these issues. Those same 545 human beings spend much of their energy convincing you and me that what they did is not their fault. They're out there busily saying, well, it's not me. It's those other members out there. It's those Republicrats or those Demopublicans that did it, not me. They cooperate in this common con regardless of the party that they're affiliated with. Now, what separates a politician from any normal human being is an excessive amount of gall. No normal human being would have the gall of a speaker who stood up and then criticized the president for creating deficits. The president can only propose the budget. The president cannot force the Congress to accept it. So when the Speaker of the House jumps up and points her finger at George Bush and says, well, it's George Bush did this. George Bush did that. George, it's all the Republicans over here. That's BS. BS. The president, it is true, gets up in front of Congress every year and he stands up and says, well, here's what I want to propose. Here's what I think that we ought to do. But the Congress does not have to do that. And the Congress, of and by themselves, can bypass the president altogether. Bypassing. Those 535 members there in the Congress can enact all the legislation, run the government, and just leave the president right out of the loop. So, the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land, gives sole responsibility to the House of Representatives for originating and approving appropriations and taxes. Now, who is the Speaker of the House? Her name is Nancy Pelosi. She's the leader of the majority party. It's Nancy Pelosi and her fellow House members, not the President, who can approve any budget that they want. And if the President vetoes that budget, they can pass it right over his veto if they agree to. Those 435 members of the House of Representatives can just tell the President to shove it. You know, if they wanted to. So it seems inconceivable to me that a nation of 300 million people cannot replace 545 people who stand convicted by the present facts of their incompetence and irresponsibility. And I can't think of a single domestic problem that is not traceable directly to those same 545 people. Not a single one. You can take any issue that you can think of. I don't care whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or George Bush or Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid or just name them. Each and every one of those members of the Congress has the power to change that. And they haven't done it over the past 75 years. Now, we're in an election cycle. And people are excited in this country about the election. And they're going to vote for change. Excuse me, if the same Republicans and Democrats over the past 75 years have produced 100% of all the problems that we have today. What in the hell makes you think that over the next 75 years, these same Republicans and Democrats are going to change that? Huh? Now, I'm just a crummy plumber out here, you know, but I'm looking at 75 years of total failure. And somebody the other day said, how are you going to vote? I said, I'm not going to vote. And they looked at me like like Judy Hartson, you know, she's going to run over and tell Mr. Witten, you know, my God, look what that little Georgie Gordon's up to now. Now, these 545 people, when you fully grasp the plain truth that these 545 people exercise the power of the federal government, then it must follow that what exists is what these 545 people want to exist. That if you have inflation, these 545 people want inflation. If you have high taxes, these 545 people want high taxes. If you want an open border with Mexico, these 545 people want it. Now, I noticed that the Russians built a wall over there in Berlin, you know. They did not want East Germans escaping and going over to West Germany. Built a big wall, said, no, can't leave. We can't do that here with Mexico. We didn't have a Mexican problem here 50 or 75, 100, 200 years ago, you know. This Mexican immigration problem, you know, just cropped up here in the last 10, 15 years. So I gotta say, you know, if you think it's longer than 10 or 15, let's go back 30 or 40 years, we didn't have any problem with Mexico. Immigrants, illegal immigrants coming in here. But all of a sudden we have, something happened. I'm not here to, you know, tell you, well, it was NAFTA that did it or GATT or that was globalized free trade or whatever the hell it is. I'm just pointing out to you that, you know, we elect these people and send them off to Washington because we presume they're smarter than we are and that they can spend full time, you know, grappling with these problems of immigration and taxes and tax policy and the IRS and GMOs and all the rest of it. Because you and I are out here busy actually producing and creating the real goods and services for which, you know, we get paid, and that's the way we make our livings. So we presume that these people in Washington are doing the same thing, but over 75 years they've been a 100% total failure. Both parties, every single member, I mean all of them collectively, 545 people. Now you can sit there and say, well, we got this one guy, Ron Paul, he's one good guy over here. Okay. How come we don't have 545 Ron Pauls? Who in the hell are you people voting for? I mean, Ron Paul isn't in my neck of the woods or my district. We got a guy, we have a communist by the name of Kit Bond, you know. He's our senator here. One of them. Now, the members of our Congress are all practicing communists except for this one guy, Ron Paul. You know, the heavy progressive income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. We have in this country the heavy progressive income tax. It was enacted by those 545 people sitting in our Congress, sitting in our White House, sitting in our Supreme Court. Same 545 people. Now, you could sit there and say, well, that was back in 1913. That 545 people back in 1913 did that. But the 545 people in 1914, 15, 25, 35, 55, 75, and 2005 didn't repeal it, did they? They didn't fix the mistake, did they? And I don't hear of any candidates running for office today that are telling you they want to repeal the income tax. Or that they want to whip inflation now. I haven't heard that. They all decry it and blame it on somebody else. Hillary Clinton's blaming it on George Bush, and George Bush is blaming it on Hillary. Excuse me. When the Republicans are in power, did they change it? When the Democrats are in power, did they change it? Both the Republicans and the Democrats follow, practice, advocate, use, and are out busily selling you the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, a heavy progressive income tax, and you people love it. Now, you don't like this heavy taxation, but you don't want to repeal it. And you don't want to vote in anybody that's going to change it. How's that wash? Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in 112 countries daily over the internet and radio worldwide. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. And then, finally, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or call us at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the food crisis. To give you a little background on the food crisis, the reason that you have 69% here in America, 69% increase in your food prices is because of 545 members of our Congress, the White House, and Supreme Court. Those are the people that control it. Now, they either control it or they failed to control it. They did something or they failed to do something. Now, there are no insoluble governmental problems. If they do not receive Social Security, but they're an elite retirement plan not available to the people, it's because they want it that way. I don't know if you knew this or not, but the members of Congress have their own retirement program. You and I have a Social Security retirement program that I've reported on many times here. That nobody with an IQ above 80 would subscribe to, support, or impose upon another human being. And indeed, these 545 members of the Congress, the Supreme Court, and the President do not participate in Social Security, which they have imposed upon you and me. They have their own system, much more generous, but it's also sustainable, whereas Social Security is not. It's a Ponzi scheme. Now, those people that are in the White House are not suffering from low IQs. Not a single member of the Congress is suffering from an IQ or a deficit in his intellectual capacity. Not one. And furthermore, I don't ever remember of ever having heard of any member of government from George Washington to the present day that ever suffered from an IQ deficiency sitting in the halls of Congress. And if you have, would you please tell me who that was? Send me an email. So if the tax code is unfair, it is because these 545 people want it to be unfair. If our budget is in a deficit or in the red, it's because these 545 people want it that way. If the Marines are in Iraq, it's because these 545 people want those Marines in Iraq. Now, are you going to allow these 545 people to shift the blame then to the bureaucrats that they hire and whose jobs they can abolish. They can fire every one of those bureaucracies. If you think that the EPA or OSHA or that the Veterans Administration or any of these agencies that are staffed with all these bureaucrats over here are the problem, Congress can terminate those problems in the morning. If there's a problem with the Veterans Administration not giving out the benefits that they have promised to the veterans, it's because the Congress wants it that way. The President wants it that way. So whatever is going on there is because these 545 people either created it or have failed to correct it. Now listen to this. If you're an immigrant over the age of 65, I mean, you're coming into the United States and you're over 65 years old, you can apply for Social Security and Medicaid, and you can get more than my mother gets from Social Security. And my mother worked from 1944 until 2004. And she gets $791 a month because she was born in 1924. Now, it's interesting that the federal government provides a single refugee with a monthly allowance of $1,890. That's more than double. And each one of those immigrants can also obtain an additional $580 in social assistance for a total of $2,470 a month. So, if you're an immigrant over the age of 65, you can get $2,470 a month out of Social Security and Medicaid and never have worked a day in the United States and never paid a single dollar into the system. Now, this compares very well to a single pensioner who, after contributing to the growth and development of America for 40 or 50 years, can receive a maximum monthly allowance of $1,012 a month in old age pension and guaranteed income supplement. Maybe our pensioners should apply as refugees. But consider sending this to all of your American friends so that we can all be ticked off. And maybe we can get refugees cut back to $1,012 and the pensioners moved up to $2,470 and enjoy some of the money they were forced to submit to the government over the past 40, 50, or 60 years. Now, if that in your mind is an inequity, honest to God, do you believe that Nancy Pelosi, George Bush, and Harry Reid do not know that? Boys and girls, I'm a crummy plumber, and I know that. I just reported it to you. Now, maybe you did not know that a refugee coming into the United States, now I'm assuming, of course, as a refugee, you're 65 years old. You could be a refugee from Iraq or Afghanistan. You could be a refugee from any place in the world, and we're taking in somewhere in the neighborhood, you know, in this country. About 2 million people a year come here to the United States. A certain number of those people are 65 or older. Not all of them, by any stretch of the imagination, but a certain point. Boys and girls, if one person can come into this country and collect 10 cents more than a native-born American, there's something wrong with that. Isn't there? Now, the old adage says charity begins at home. Now, we're talking about food crisis, but I wanted to give you the political background from which we're moving forward to the food crisis. Yeah, there's a food crisis going on. It's going to affect you in America, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Western Europe. You're going to have ration cards shortly. You're going to have national identification cards. And without your national identification card, you will not get a ration card. And without a ration card, you won't eat. And there's a story in the book of Revelation about that. I don't know if you've ever heard this before. Some of you may be brand new to this, but there's a time coming in the world, not just here in the United States, but worldwide, when you won't be able to buy, sell, or trade unless you have this particular mark. And it says here, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. Now, if that doesn't sound like a chip implant, you know, write me a letter and tell me what does it sound like to you. and that no man might buy or sell save he that has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So here is wisdom. Let him that has understanding count the number of the beast, because it's the number of a man, and his number is 666. That's in Revelation 13, verses 16, 17, and 18. That's a part of the coming food crisis. In Revelation chapter 6, there's what we call the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You ever heard that story before? You know, somebody must have told you about the four horsemen or riding. You know, we use it in our culture here in the United States quite often. And in verse 5, this is Revelation 6, verse 5, when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, come out and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see that you hurt not the oil and the wine. Now, the Bible is filled with stories of famines, and there's an example of a great famine that occurred in Egypt back in Joseph's day, you know, 3,000 plus years ago. And a number of famines. And as I mentioned when we opened, I said, the world has never had a worldwide famine. Now we have globalization and we have world trade, and now we have the specter of a world famine. And the shortage of wheat being produced in Australia affects a person who lives in Mauritania or Haiti. Rice that's being grown in South Vietnam or in Burma affects the health, safety, and welfare of people living in Africa and South America. And it affects the price that you pay for rice here in the United States. The price of rice has doubled in the last 90 days. Now, I wouldn't care if the price of rice doubled again, and then doubled again, and then doubled again, because I hate the stuff. I don't eat rice if I can possibly avoid it. You know, once in a while somebody puts it on my plate. And so I have to bury it in gravy or bury it in butter or something to kill the taste of it and choke it down. I couldn't care less about rice. But more than half of the world's population depend upon rice as their daily bread. That's their basic food. Now, the tragedy of it is, in the third world, is that when a guy is making $4 a day, in the Philippines, and he is already spending 80% of $4 a day. Let's just take $4 times 0.80. The guy's spending $3.20 a day on rice. He's spending $3.20 a day on food. Now double the price of food to $6.40. Or, you know, better yet, if we just took the price of food and raised it by 69%. What it does is it prices this guy right out of the market. He can no longer afford food. Now he has to spend 100% of what he has on food, and now he has less food to eat than he had last week. That's the tragedy. And we're going to see literally billions, spelled with a B, like boy, billions of people die now because of the policies that have been or the policies that have not been enacted by these 545 people. Now, it's true, you got people over there in your legislatures in Germany and France and over in China and Russia that are also exacerbating the problem. But it's the United States of America that has military bases in 732 countries, 732 military bases around the world in 137 countries, I believe it is. It's in more than 100 countries that we have 732 military bases, last time I saw some numbers on the subject. This is a Roman Empire that eclipsed the Roman Empire and the British Empire and the German Empire. I mean, this is an empire that's worldwide in scope. It's on the verge of collapse. It's on the verge of destruction. And when it goes out of business, it's going to have economic, social, it's going to have political and religious consequences that are going to reverberate around the world. In fact, it's going to have consequences that can only be described in biblical terms. And you and I are on the, are sitting right here on the 50-yard line, watching it all go by. So I thought at least we ought to report on some of these big events. I mean, Katie Couric has got human interest stories, and they call that news. And they're not reporting on the food crisis. They're not telling you, boys and girls, that you've got 3.5 billion people in the world living on $2 a day. And 80% of that money is going for food, and we just doubled the price. Doubled it. See, over the last 5 or 6 years, the price of food has more than doubled worldwide. And it doesn't make any difference to say, well, in their economies, they have a lower standard of living. 80% of what they're spending on food is being spent on food. And when you're importing that food from Vietnam, China, Japan, Burma, wherever it's being grown, there's a world price. And when the price of rice goes from $600 to $900 a ton, or goes from $900 a ton to $2,000 a ton, boys and girls, those people over there have to spend twice as much in their local currency to buy that local rice. A story came out of Australia. Did you know that 98% of the rice crop in Australia has been lost? 98%. The Australians, until recent years, were producing enough rice in Australia to feed 20 million people. Now, you know, 20 million people, you know, 30 million people live in Australia. And a rice industry that feeds 20 million people is a drop in the bucket. I don't deny it. But when you eliminate, when you take out 98% of Australia's rice production, that's not a step forward, that's a step backward, isn't it? I mean, you already got 20 million people a year starving to death in the world. There's 100 million new people born in the world every year. 20 million of them die from starvation. That's up from 15 million years a year, which was the traditional, you know, that's been the historic norm or average, you know, for many years, up past 20 now. Now, there is an impending problem. There's a cause and effect relationship that we're observing here. And it's going to impact upon all of us. And it's going to impact upon us economically and politically and socially. It's going to impact upon us militarily. These people are going to get upset. They're going to get excited. You know, people that are in their death throes, you know, start kicking and squirming. And it's tragic, and I don't deny it, but it's going to affect all of us, whether we like it or not. That's why I suggest that, you know, from time to time, I say, don't you think that maybe instead of listening to Hartman on Katie Couric, that maybe we ought to pay attention to what's going on that's kind of serious? I mean, there's some serious events about to transpire, and they all have consequences. All those consequences are going to affect all of us. Now, here's a CBS News bulletin here. Listen to this. It's only mid-morning in Logan, Ohio, but as CBS News correspondent Cynthia Bowers reports, some of the food is already running out. Twice a month in this small town on the edge of Appalachia, groceries are given away, and you could call it a line of the times, because in the growing number of American communities, making ends meet means waiting for a handout. The line stretches down the road and out of sight, and most, like Ginger Walls, never imagined that they'd be standing here in this line. She says of her food situation at home, well, my cupboards aren't real full, and my kids don't have a lot to choose from. They are embarrassed, and they don't want to talk, but they're far from alone. Each year, an estimated 30 million Americans go hungry. Some places, like Logan, have it worse than others. We're not really on the bottom, but we're at a point where we still need the help, says Bob Callender. Virginia Luzier admits to needing the help. She says without the trunk load or trunk full of groceries, she'd go hungry. I just live on Social Security, and that's not a very good living, says Luzier. The line makes clear that any economic recovery has bypassed this community. When it started 2 years ago, volunteers were feeding 17 families. Now it's well over 500 families. And as I just reported, you can take this old lady. Now listen to this. I just live on Social Security, and that's not a very good living, says this old lady. Excuse me. But if you're an immigrant from Iraq, 65 years old, you can get $2,400 a month. Now, Goodyear is just one of at least a half dozen plants around here that have relocated or closed in the last few years, taking with them thousands of jobs. Where do you think that Goodyear relocated? Well, they moved offshore to Bangladesh or Ceylon or Taiwan or South Korea. Jobs that have been counted on for generations and jobs that will not be coming back. Now, this free trade and globalization was enacted by those 545 people in your Congress, the White House, and the Supreme Court. Same 545 people created that. Bill Clinton signed a NAFTA and GATT. He said it was a good plan. I'm not a politician. I'm not here to tell you, you know, that you ought to vote for this guy or that. I'm just here as a reporter telling you that, hey, listen, it was Republicans and Democrats over the past 75 years that have created this free trade and globalization. You know, prior to 1933, we didn't have any of that crap. And somebody came along and told you that free trade and globalization was good for you. You bought into it, voted them into office. Well, here's the outcome. You know, wake up, smell the coffee. Not everyone is unemployed, but many live on minimum wage. You have to make hard choices, they say, and the free food that they receive means more money to clothe the kids, or in some cases, to buy life-saving medicine. I don't have enough money to buy three of my prescriptions, says Mary Travis. I'm on 9 prescriptions, so you have to do without, and food inventories are dwindling. And at the local office of America's Second Harvest, a hunger relief organization that gives away 81 million pounds of food a year in Ohio alone, donations are drying up at the very worst time. We've seen an 18% increase in the demand for services in just the first 3 months of this year, says Lisa Hamler. We're seeing a new phenomenon. Last year's food bank donors are now this year's food bank recipients. Back on the line, Walls wonders about priorities and waits with so many others. I find it very hard to see Americans providing for all of the other countries in the world, and yet we're suffering here also, says Walls. It's just not right. We're supposed to look out for ourselves, our own brothers and our own sisters. We used to have an old adage in this country, you know, that charity begins at home. Charity begins at home. Now, the tragedy here is that none of these 500 people can plant a garden. They cannot provide their own food. They don't know how. Americans are now locked up in their cities. They couldn't feed themselves if their lives depended on it. And shortly, Americans' lives are going to depend upon what they can produce for themselves to feed their own families. And not feeding the people in Bangladesh or feeding the people across the world, but feeding the people right here in the United States is going to become job one very shortly. Well, I'm about out of time here, boys and girls. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio worldwide. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, all of these law or programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal. Our time is up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.